Good afternoon and welcome to today's webcast, Getting Started in Volunteer Water Quality Monitoring. This webcast is sponsored by EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds and the Watershed Academy. My name is Ron O'Rell. I am with Tetra Tech and will moderate today's session. We will get started in a few moments. While we wait for others to join, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items. This is very important as our seminar is filled to capacity today. The materials in this webcast have been reviewed by EPA staff for technical accuracy. However, the views of the speakers and the speakers' organizations are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the EPA. Mention of any commercial enterprise, product, or publication does not mean that EPA endorses them. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific web address. This webpage contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included photos and short bios of today's presenters. Please note that the speakers' email addresses are hot-linked on that page in case you have questions for them after today's presentation. I'll explain later how you can ask questions today. For those of you joining us via the phone, we require that you mute your phone during the seminar. During the webcast, we will have several question and answer sessions, at which point you are welcome to take your phone off mute and ask a question when you are called upon. I will force mute the group while the presenters are talking, and then unmute the group during the question and answer sessions. We appreciate those participants who have downloaded the presentation in advance of the webcast to help improve performance. I now ask you to go to slide 1 of the presentation. If you are viewing today's slides online, by now you should have clicked on the Go to Seminar button and be on slide number 1 of the presentation. When viewing the slides online, you will find navigation buttons at the top of the page. To submit questions during the seminar, click the button showing a question mark. You do not need to wait until the question and answer periods to submit your questions. In fact, we do encourage you to submit them in advance of the question and answer sessions. You may also use the question mark button to alert us to any technical difficulties you encounter with the audio stream. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we will help you troubleshoot your problem. One note about the question and answer sessions today. For those of you who downloaded your slides, you will note that there are a few question slides that we will skip, and I will make an announcement to that effect. There will also be one question and answer period that is not indicated in the slides, and we, of course, will notify you of that as well. If you would like to activate the closed captioning feature, simply click on the CC button at the top of the page. Click on the button a second time to deactivate the feature. Please note that you must use Internet Explorer 5.5 or higher to use the closed captioning feature. The speakers will announce the number of the slide to which they are moving. If viewing the slides online, you may advance to the next slide by clicking the single right arrow button located above the slide. Phone participants or others who have downloaded the presentation ahead of time can click on the appropriate slide number in your left-hand frame. And one note to add about the slides, for those of you who have downloaded the slides, slide number 61 is inadvertently designed as a hidden slide. So we will notify you of that as we get there, but do note that slide number 61 does appear hidden. You will need to take some steps to unhide that slide. At the end of today's seminar, we will direct you to our links page, where we have assembled a series of resources directly applicable to today's topic. The links page will be archived indefinitely, along with the seminar, so you can access it after today's live presentation. We typically archive seminars with their soundtracks, and seminars are now also available as a podcast. So in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation just as it was given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form, which we ask you to consider submitting. We do look at your comments as we continue to improve our webcast content and delivery mechanisms. Before I turn it over to our first speaker, I remind phone participants to monitor their own participation and noise levels. Please mute your phones at this time. Okay, enough of the housekeeping. I think we're ready to kick off this session. Today's webcast will be about starting a volunteer water quality monitoring program. Instructors will discuss key steps to follow, questions to ponder, examples of success stories, and where the best resources are for further information. They will also introduce a tiered approach to ensure the best use of volunteer collected data. Our first speaker will be Linda Green, who directs the Watershed Watch program at the University of Rhode Island, where she has directed that program since it was formed 20 years ago. Linda co-leads an effort to expand and enhance volunteer monitoring and extension programs nationwide. Linda represented the volunteer monitoring community on the National Water Quality Monitoring Council for 9 years. She co-chaired its collaboration and outreach committee and also co-chaired two council conferences. Linda will be followed by Danielle Donkersloot, who is with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Danielle coordinates New Jersey's volunteer monitoring programs under one umbrella organization called the Watershed Watch Network. She represents the volunteer monitoring community on the New Jersey Water Quality Monitoring Council, and she has also been providing support and guidance to the volunteer community for several years. We have an exciting presentation today, so let's get started. I'll now turn the microphone over to Linda Green. Good afternoon, Linda.
Good afternoon, Ron, and welcome everybody to this webcast. This is very exciting for Danielle and I, and we welcome all of you. And it's going to be an interesting experience for us to do a workshop without being able to see any of the participation or get your visual feedback. So we're going to try to imagine your expression. And right now, if you're interested in starting a volunteer monitoring program, now is the time to begin planning for next spring or next summer. You'll need to spend a lot of time thinking and discussing. Fortunately, there are a lot of resources to help you out. Really, what I would entitle this website, this webcast, is Things to Think About Before Getting Your Feet Wet. Now I'm going to move to slide two. On slide two is the overall of this afternoon's webcast. And Danielle and I will be touching on each topic listed here, from characteristics of successful programs right down to New Jersey's tiered approach. And just about any of these topics could be the subject of an all-day seminar. But so this webcast is, in essence, it's an overview itself, and much, much more detail can be found in the resources that are listed on the website for this program, and you're also very welcome to get in touch with Danielle and myself afterwards. Now we're on slide three, and we're talking about successful water quality monitoring programs and what their characteristics are. Across the country, there are somewhere in the vicinity to between 800 and 1,200 volunteer monitoring programs. And although there are very, very many varieties of programs, all of the successful programs share certain characteristics. And these are the characteristics. They're well organized. They have a sound scientific basis. They report their results. They have strong institutional support. They make a difference. In the next couple of slides, I'm going to talk about each of these characteristics. I'm now on slide four. Being well organized is critical to the success of any new program. You need to figure out what you hope to do. What's the purpose of your program? Who's going to help you out? Partnerships can be a great resource. They can provide brain power. They can provide some organizing expertise. They can provide some technical advice. They can be a source of volunteers. And they can be a source of also other partnerships with other organizations. And they can tell you what worked for them, what didn't work for them, and encourage further partnerships. Good relationships with your decision makers are also critical. Many programs get started because of a perceived problem and a perceived adversarial relationship, which may or may not exist. But in the long run, getting along well with your decision makers and the folks that you hope will in part use your data is very important for the success of a program. And they can provide some good markers on where you need to go and good ways to get there. Clear roles for everybody involved in the volunteer monitoring program, from the leadership, the board, the staff, and the volunteers, is very, very important. This creates proper expectations for everybody who's involved in the program. It keeps folks from feeling overused and undervalued, and I cannot stress that. I'm now on slide five. And we're talking about what a sound scientific basis means. It means that you've developed and thought about some monitoring goals and some questions you want to answer. Writing down your study design and documenting those details is time-consuming, but it's critical. It helps us and helps you really clarify what it is you hope to accomplish. And we're going to go into study designs a little bit more further on. And we need to document everything you're going to do for all your monitoring activities. and you want to make sure that the documentation is based on some established method. In terms of complexity, many programs start small and they grow over time. Another thing you want to consider is that what's appropriate for adults may not be appropriate for school children in terms of what they're doing, how they're doing it, when they're doing it. Some programs that are now very big got started with measuring one or two key parameters and added more as the years progressed, as their technical support increased, and as they felt more comfortable with what they were doing in their program. Out in Wisconsin, the Water Action Volunteers began with 5 parameters monitored and then added a 6th after a couple of years. Watershed Watch, we got started with a good suite of them, but we realized a couple of years into the program we were interested in bacterial monitoring and added that on later and added other things as we came aboard with different groups. Now, Quality Assurance QA stands for Quality Assurance, and you're going to hear a lot more about this, particularly in Danielle's part. One of the things that I always use as my example is you want to make sure that you're not doing too much work documenting what you're doing, but you need to be able to explain what you're doing to people who might not understand it. And that for data that's used by scientific and regulatory agencies, they may have very specific quality assurance requirements before they will use any data. Okay, I'm now on slide 6. And that's about not just collecting data. Successful programs report and they use their results. The data just do not sit on a shelf or on a CD or in a database. The data are turned into results. Results are turned into a story, and the story are reviewed by data users and resource people. The reports are tailored and reported in various ways depending on who your audience is. What might be useful for a technical report for county, state, or federal government could be useless to the folks in the local watershed groups, the local folks on the Conservation Commission who need to understand in ways that they can understand what the data means. We need to make sure that the results and the data are turned into action and that we also can use, hopefully, our monitoring to assess progress in meeting some of our goals. Some of our reports are transmitted to the public in news articles. Some are translated in brochures. Some are translated in annual reports. Lots of different ways to get the words out. Lots of different ways to make it informative and interesting. I'm now on slide 7, and this is kind of a summary of the introduction about successful programs, and I think this is key. This is key to me as I've watched my children grow up and as I've seen the proliferation of computers, computer games, things like that. What we are doing when we're starting a successful volunteer monitoring program is really involving people in real science. We really need to push this in our country. I think it's very, very important. We need to make folks realize that most questions aren't answered CSI style as they are on those very popular TV shows. In other words, most questions are not answered nearly instantly. It takes a while to get good answers. It takes a while to understand what those answers mean. Successful programs raise awareness of what's going on. It's good to focus on your community, however you define it. You can create an informed constituency when you've got volunteers, monitors out there, people who are more fluent in science and in what the science jargon means and can translate it to people who work with them. Volunteer monitoring also promotes individual action for water quality protection. The action starts local and can very much build up. It can provide information where nobody else is looking. Many of our state and federal programs take a statistical approach where they will choose sites to make sure they're random, to make sure they're answering big questions. Many of our concerns in our volunteer monitoring programs is answering local questions in areas of local concern. And also, many of our government programs are really keyed towards figuring out what problems are and how to solve problems in areas where there are water quality issues. We don't see a lot of government programs that focus on high-quality resources and high-quality waters. And it's very important for volunteer monitoring also to take that into account. We have a group of trout fishermen who are monitoring a stream, and the whole purpose of their monitoring is because they feel the stream is such high quality and so appropriate for native trout that they want to make sure that folks in agencies and watershed groups appreciate the good and high quality aspects of the stream. Okay, now I'm going to move on to slide 8. And that's about the main uses of volunteer data. In queries that have been done over the years of volunteer monitoring programs from across the country, we have realized that there are about 4 main uses of volunteer data. And they are water quality or watershed education, to document existing conditions. For example, as when my program started, there was nothing known about many of the lakes in Rhode Island and nothing known about many of the smaller streams. Some programs exist to document problems, to say what they are, what's causing them. Many programs exist because they want to influence local decisions. How you plan your program and what you're going to do with your program depends a great deal on what your ultimate aim is. What you really want to answer, this is the key question. Why are you getting started in volunteer monitoring? This is key. This is the basis of your involvement. And you need to be able to explain it, as Danielle will say, so that your mother can understand, so that a non-technical person can understand, so you can talk about it to school children as well as to politicians. I've been involved in a monitoring collaborative in Rhode Island for quite a while, and we have written reams and reams of reports. But now we're down to making sure that we can express what we want to do in a one-page, large font handout so that we can give that to our local leaders so that they can understand what we're involved in also. So here's one of the first steps. I'm on slide 10 now. First thing you need to do is find out what existing information there is. In many cases, there's a lot more information than you might expect. In many cases, there's not much. What kind of information is there about Cold Brook? In one of our stream programs, neighbors didn't even know that the stream flowing through their backyard had a name, where it came from, and where it flowed to. Once we were able to attach a name to that stream for these people, they started to get involved because they realized it actually had a meaning. So you need to find out about the resource. What are the goals of the organization who's going to be involved in the volunteer monitoring? What are the goals of the community? Are they trying to improve a stream that's been neglected for years? Are they trying to make sure that a swimming beach is safe and usable? What about current and past monitoring or research efforts? One of my favorite definitions of limnology, other than being the study of the ecology of lakes and ponds, is the second half, and that is that it's the study of lakes and ponds that are within 3 hours of a major university. Often we see intensive research efforts on a body of water for a certain number of years, but often not long term. And until recently, there just hasn't been enough effort made to compile all data that's available so that everybody can look through it and everybody can see what's been done. It's also good when you're getting started in volunteer monitoring to find out about volunteer monitoring in general. And there's lots of information about that out and about, and we'll be going into some details about that in a little bit later. I'm now on slide 11. And these are some of the questions to consider when you're compiling information. Many of these are modified from EPA's Volunteer Stream Monitoring Methods Manual. So what aquatic environment are you interested in monitoring? Are you interested in lakes? Are you interested in streams? Are you interested in wetlands? Are you fortunate enough that you're going to be monitoring coral reefs and get to go to the Caribbean? Are you going to be monitoring groundwater? Why are you monitoring it? What is the driving reason behind your interest in monitoring this particular environment or this particular water body? Who's going to use the data? Is it going to be the local group? Or is it going to be local government or state government? Now, it's important to remember that although many groups think that their data is going to be used by county or state or even federal government, oftentimes it won't. But even more importantly, any group that's doing volunteer monitoring should really make sure that they are the primary users of the data. After all, that's a good reason to have a monitoring program. It will to help the group and to help meet its purposes. And how's the data going to be used? Is it going to be a general statement of what's going on? Is it going to be specific? How good does the data need to be? And what is it that you're actually going to monitor? What are those parameters? We'll discuss those a little bit more. Do you have any resources to help you with your monitoring? Is there funding available to buy supplies? Are there labs available to analyze water samples? Who can help you with your program? And has anybody ever done this before? There is definitely, in our busy times, no need to reinvent the wheel. We can also, I would also urge you in the resources to look at the USDA CSRES Guide for Growing. We've got a specific fact sheet on designing your monitoring strategy that can help you address some of these questions and walk you through some of these steps. I'm now on slide 12, and this is a very important one, and that's also to assess what is possible. What I think is so important and what I've found so wonderful as being a part of a volunteer monitoring program is how much ordinary people can accomplish, given the right training, the right equipment, and the right encouragement. Some of the best volunteers in my program are what I would consider ordinary folks. And actually, some of my most difficult volunteers are research scientists. So you want to consider what the skills and knowledge are of your volunteers and what the levels of data use and uses are. And Danielle is going to go into this in her talk about New Jersey's tiered programs. She has taken this to a great level of detail. What's the level of commitment for the folks who are volunteering? Some folks might be looking for a one-time opportunity to volunteer. Some may be willing to go out once a week. Some may think they can go out once a week, and the reality is that they need to go, that they really don't have the time to do that. Now I'm on slide 13, and that is talking about study design. This is where you actually write down who, what, where, and why is going on. You need to have this come out of the goals of your program. You want to reflect the resources, and you want to realize that your study design, one of the most difficult steps, is really important for success. The National Water Quality Monitoring Council, on slide 14, has developed a framework for monitoring where they actually spent several years looking at how monitoring works, what are the questions you need to ask, and what are the steps you need to do in developing a monitoring program. They have six steps here, and I've added two at the beginning and the end, starting from assessing the need to the program all the way going through to evaluate your program. And again, I would urge you to go to the resources at the end to find the details about it, because this could be a whole talk in itself. In terms of goals and objectives, what do you want to have happen? I want residents to swim safely in deep reservoir. You want to have specific and objective measurements. These are on slide 15. I want to be able to see the bottom. I want to reduce algae blooms. I want to reduce phosphorus concentrations. These might be some very good objectives. The goal is to start simple and to start small, and to realize that you can revise your goals and objectives as you go along. On slide 16, we have a listing of the top parameters monitored by volunteers across the country. And this was done from an assessment in 1998. And what the take-home message from this is that the parameters monitored by our volunteers, whether it's lakes or rivers and streams, are actually just about the same as those monitored by professionals. Some have been modified to make it easier to collect samples, to modify elsewhere. But the fact is, what volunteer monitoring is doing is very similar to what professionals have done. And one thing I did want to mention is that when this was done, bacteria monitoring didn't rank as high in importance as I think it would now. And if you want to find out more about volunteer monitoring for bacteria, the most recent issue of the Volunteer Monitor newsletter is devoted to this in its entirety. Now, there are a number of sources to locate methods. I'm on slide 17. There are many guidance manuals by EPA. The Volunteer Monitor newsletter is just a wonderful source of information on methods, and it's topically oriented. All of this is available online. Some of our equipment suppliers have great and informative catalogs and also information to go along with that. The Secchi Diffin website has a lot of good information. You can go to the kind of Bible for the detailed explanation, the standard methods. Conference, workshops, and listservs are also great sources for methods. I'm on slide 18 now, and this is where it kind of gets to the basis of everything. What we're doing is that there is really a continuum of monitoring data use. And my good friend and colleague, Jeff Bates, illustrated this very well. When you're going through those four, trying to figure out where your program is, if it's an educational and a problem assessing, or you're doing local decision making, if you're moving to those few programs that deal with legal and regulatory systems, you're really seeing a need for increased time, increased rigor in your program, increased quality, and an increase in money spent to do the monitoring. And up above that are some examples of the kind of equipment or kits you might need. If you're doing an educational program, you might use a World Water Monitoring Kit. If you're really working with legal and regulatory, you may have someone in a lab using a very expensive instrument to analyze your sample, or you might actually find that some of your kits are appropriate. I'm going to move on to slide 19 now, where we're talking a little bit about the design of the program, not so much the science design, but how you're going to manage your program. And I'm going to talk a little bit about all the bullets here, from training, support, management, and getting along with your sponsoring and your data program. So I'm going to move now to slide 20. Now, one of the most important decisions you can make in terms of designing your program is how you're going to set it up. Is your staff going to be all volunteer? Is it going to be paid? Or is it going to be a combination? One of the most important things to recognize is that having a dedicated staff is critical to success. This can't be added on to somebody else's job, somebody who's too busy doing other things. And it can't be added on successfully to somebody who's already doing everything they can for your program. You want to think about what the home organization is going to be also. Is it going to be university? Is it going to be at a land trust? Is it going to be at an agency? Good things to think about where you're figuring out where you're going to go. The second thing to consider is what kind of management style your program is going to have. Is it going to be an umbrella program that acts as a service provider? Or is it going to be more of a direct management program that provides the umbrella services, plus recruiting, data reporting, financial management? And it's kind of a combination of the two in between. I'm now moving on to slide 22, where another consideration is who you're going to have do your analyses, and those are the ones not done out in the field. We know that our volunteers can do many of the on-site analyses, but sometimes they need to be done in a more strict method in a more laboratory setting. In-house programs, where our programs have their own equipment, their own analysts, it can be pretty resource intensive. You've got to have the space, the equipment, the expertise. It can be convenient because you can rerun your samples if you're not satisfied the results you thought you'd get. It allows you to have the full control of quality on your program, but it can be very limited by what you have or what you can afford. Moving on to slide 23, many programs actually use contract labs where water samples, if that's what you're doing, are sent to an established laboratory. It's less resource intensive, but you are paying for a per sample basis, although you may be able to get a break from the lab. You don't have to have technical knowledge. It's a little easier, but you're depending on that lab for its quality assurance. And one of the things we have noted is if you're sending samples to a lab that's used to doing wastewater analyses, their limits of detection may be very high, and too high if you're also sending them very clean lake or stream water to analyze. However, sending your samples out to a lab is often viewed as more credible. Whether that's true or not is arguable, but it certainly is thought of that way. One of the things I want to mention in terms of, I'm on slide 24 now, about getting involved, certainly at a local level, and a great way to get started with any kind of volunteer monitoring is to participate in World Water Monitoring Day, which is coming up right at the end of this week. And actually, folks can go out and do their monitoring now. And I encourage you to go to the website here and learn all about World Water Monitoring Day. The photo below is an example of a fairly inexpensive kit you can get out that's wonderful for screening level, for education and outreach. Moving on to slide 25, another great program to get involved with for folks measuring water clarity is the Great North American SECI Dip-In that started in 1994, and it is headquartered at Kent State University. It also has a great compilation of resources for volunteer monitoring. And now I'm on slide 26 and with some time for questions.
Yes, thanks, Linda. As Linda mentioned, we are on slide 26, our first question and answer period. We do encourage folks to submit your questions if you're participating online by clicking the question mark button and typing your question. We'll also open the phone lines to take questions from those who are participating via the 866 number. In the interest of time, we'll limit our questions to two on this round, and Linda, I'll ask the first one. This one comes from Nancy in Washington State, who writes that one of the first things her group came up against in talking about water quality monitoring was the word monitoring itself. It sounded to farmers and others like her group was looking over their shoulder, checking what they were doing. So to deal with that, they've switched to the term research rather than monitoring. Have you or are you aware of others who have come up against this, and are there other ways to talk about volunteer monitoring in a non-threatening way to those who might be affected?
That's interesting. I haven't heard of using it as research versus monitoring. I know my colleague Chris in Wisconsin ran up against some issues with farmers being concerned, and so she involved them as volunteers in the program. And I know that there are other groups that have done that, and that has been quite successful. So I know folks who have used the term voluntary monitoring instead of volunteer monitoring. I've also heard of the terms community-based monitoring and citizen monitoring. That's kind of some of the other terms.
Okay, thanks, Linda. At this time, I'd like to unmute the phone line and see if there are any questions from those participating via the phone. If you have a question, please identify yourself and be recognized. No questions from the phone lines.
I'll ask one.
Okay.
This is Dave Bloomer from Wisconsin.
Dave from Wisconsin. Go ahead, Dave.
How do you balance the goal of your program between making it an education program versus a data-based or research program?
Oh, that's a good question and a tough decision to make. It is difficult to combine both. And I think you need to make your goals very clear. You might start with your program being more of an educational program, see how that works, and then perhaps move up then to a data collection program. I would tend to start at the simpler end of things and start with the education first. And actually, once you start educating and you start compiling years of data, it kind of in many ways can move itself into a more research or data-intensive program. You might have to up the water, the quality assurance. You might have to change a little bit what you're doing. But those are things you need to talk about with the people who are involved in your program.
Good, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Linda. At this point, I'm going to mute the phones again. And Linda, I'll ask you to move on to slide number 27, unmute yourself, and continue your presentation.
Okay, I'm now on slide 27, and I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and I'm going to talk about recruiting and training volunteers. And I'm going to move right on to slide 28. There are lots of ways to recruit volunteers, from articles and newspapers, newsletters, and churches, and youth groups. The one thing I would like to stress, and something that was hard for me to get used to as a scientist when I was first getting involved, is considering the press to be your ally. They are looking for stories. They may be looking for them in a little bit different way than you might like them to be looking for, but consider them your ally. You want to try to cover all your bases. If you're going to be submitting something to a newspaper, if you're going to be calling up a reporter, have it prepared as much as possible. Have a succinct press release, one page, as much as possible. Reporters are very busy, so you want to make sure that they don't have to do a lot of extra searching to get the most important points and to get them right. Remember that you are always recruiting. Every time you're out on the water, when people see what's going on, use that as an opportunity. And so are your volunteers. We're very fortunate this year to get a volunteer who's actually a photographer for the newspaper, so we've gotten some very good recruitment aspect that way. Don't be afraid to go on TV. It's a little challenging for us who are camera shy, but it's also a great way to get the message across. And I'm going to move on to slide 29 and talk about training. And training is important through the whole life of your program. Training really is a process that flows throughout the program. I'm going to talk about each of the aspects here in brief, but I want to make sure that you realize that effective volunteer training is essential for your program to be successful, and it's also essential for your volunteers to be successful. And for your program to be successful, you need to have successful volunteers. Now, many groups have different varieties of training. Some require their volunteers to take tests to show their proficiencies. Some have different levels of certification so that volunteers who've met certain goals can move on to different aspects. Some have advanced levels of training. And when we start discussing, and you can look up some of the programs, you can find what their training actually is all about and what has worked and not worked for them. So I'm moving on to slide 30, and I'm going to just cover in general the kind of topics that are covered in training programs throughout the country. And these first we have, generally folks will go for off-water or otherwise known as classroom or indoor training, and then field or on-the-water training. The off-water training can be lengthy, but it's key to the volunteer education and interest. I know some groups that will have trainings over a week, some over several nights, some half-day training sessions. But it's a key to make sure that everybody knows what they're doing, what the program's all about, and what their role is in the program. It's a way to let people know the purpose of your program, ecosystem ecology for folks who have never been involved in water monitoring in their lives, what's going on in the water bodies you're interested in, how are you going to monitor it, what are you going to do to monitor it, what the role of the volunteers are in the program, who uses the data, and how it gets out. It's also good to have local experts come in and share the training, because that way it's great to get a different person's perspective and so that folks aren't listening to one person all the time. It's also important to have some show and tell and vary the types of training that you're doing so that people after the end of the workday or on a Saturday morning aren't just sitting there getting worn out from everything that's coming in. It's also good when you're doing an off-water training program to let them know about where the field training is going to be and what it's going to entail. Slide 31 is about field training, a brief summary slide. The most important thing that we get across to all our volunteers is that everybody practices and does all the aspects of field training. Even if they think they're going to be the on-the-shore support for the person who's going out and monitoring the stream, everybody practices everything, no excuses. One of the first things I bring up when I'm involved in field training is safety. particularly when and where not to monitor. We have actually had to call our volunteers in who are going out and monitoring during a hurricane. They were that dedicated. Not something we want. And so what we make clear is that the most important aspect of any monitoring program is being safe. You don't want to trespass on private property. And in my case, you got to keep a good eye out for poison ivy. During field training, you want to review what the parameters are going to tell about the resource, the procedures. You want to demonstrate the procedures and then have each of your volunteers practice until they're comfortable. You can talk a little bit again about how reporting the data, and it's good to send everybody home with their kits so that they can start monitoring right away. One of the things that I make sure people know is that to practice before they go out and actually do their monitoring. Take a sample from their kitchen sink and practice your steps with that. And keep practicing. That old adage that practice makes perfect is very, very important. Slide 32 talks about the two general kinds of training we can have, which is group training versus one-on-one. Definitely group training can save time and money, and folks can learn from each other and feel comfortable by the fact that there are others in the same boat learning the same way they can. It sometimes can be difficult because you can't address the unique characteristics or things about individual water bodies, and you have to make sure you don't have one person kind of dominating the whole group training. One-on-one training is great in the sense that you're interacting specifically with a certain person, and you can watch the people if you go to their site under the actual conditions. It is time-consuming, and it can be expensive because time is money. But it also, when you're out in that place, that particular stream or that particular lake, you can see what's unique about it and if you need to make changes for that. Now, one of the things we notice is that what we try to do is offer our indoor or our off-water training and our field training at several times in different places. We will offer it on a weekday evening and again on a Saturday morning. We have some people who won't drive after dark. We have some people who are involved in sporting activities on the weekend. But the one thing we've told our volunteers is that if you don't have time to attend the training, how are you actually going to find the time to monitor? So I'm moving on to slide 33 now, and with some training tips. And again, as I mentioned, you want to offer training more than once. You want to try and break the topic into chunks that are manageable for people. Use experts. Get people from the outside. They can add a perspective and a knowledge that you never had, and you can learn a lot yourself. You can try, if you possible, to offer on-site assistance to go back out with people or go out individually. And one of the things that I have learned when I'm doing field training is that when I'm done talking, I need to stop talking. This can just, because when I'm talking, people get distracted from learning and from practicing, and it can lead them to make mistakes that they might not have made if I could just keep my mouth shut. And it's also important to also discourage side conversations when people are learning and practicing. Slide 34 has a few more helpful hints. Keep the size as small as you can for the class. Food and beverages. People love food. People love beverages. Provide some networking time so that not only are they practicing the steps, but they're having a chance to discuss with you and with each other what works, what doesn't work, what seems difficult. Again, bring in folks from the outside to show them what's going on, and then repeat your message over and over again. And I'm on slide 35, which is a wonderful quote from 100 Ways to Recruit Volunteers, and that our well-run volunteer programs recruit automatically. And I think the more successful your program is, the more ability you will have to finding volunteers. We do know that there are certain people who will volunteer forever. We actually have some folks in our program who've been going out every week for 6 months a year monitoring lakes. We find some people decide after a year that this is not for them. And we find that there are certain people who would love to monitor but would hate to have to discuss the results in public. Others who find monitoring very boring but are very happy to bring those results to the public, and there is room in our programs for all types. I'm going to skip slide 36 and move on to slide 37, which is resources that are available for monitoring programs, and this is definitely not an exhaustive listing. Moving on to slide 38, there is nationwide support for volunteer monitoring from a number of organizations. A great organization and sponsor of this webcast is the Environmental Protection Agency. And the EPA started supporting volunteer monitoring back in the 1980s, so they have a long-term record of supporting volunteer monitoring, and in many cases have pushed and cajoled states to come on board and support volunteer monitoring also. And I'm going to talk about listservs a little bit later. Some other nationwide programs are River Network, Sea Grant, Ocean Conservancy, all have different aspects and different associations with volunteer monitoring, and you may be able to get some very good and useful information from them, as well as from the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Now, EPA, as most folks know, not only is headquartered in Washington, but actually has regions, and the regions have volunteer monitoring coordinators, and some of the regions actually have established a volunteer monitoring equipment loan program, which can be very, very useful for folks and a way to get your chance to try out equipment you might not afford or you might not be sure that you actually need. Moving on to slide 39, this is about USDA Volunteer Monitoring Water Quality Project, and that's what's funding part of my involvement. And if you look at that huge acronym, CSRES, you can that equivalent is extension, as most people know it. This project got started in 2000. It is staffed by folks from University of Rhode Island and University of Wisconsin. And the goal of our program is to build capacity of volunteer monitoring programs across the country. Although our focus is extension, it is useful to groups anywhere. And we have a number of items available on our website and with links to program monitoring manuals, project plans, the whole listing here. And what we also have is direct links to all the extension-associated volunteer monitoring programs that we could find in the country. And we're still finding them and finding some new links, so if you are interested in being on this list, please get in touch with us. I'm now on slide 40, and this is about the fact sheet modules that our program has, again, available online, and these are the topics. From designing your monitoring strategy, we're working on effective training techniques, quality assurance. We have a new fact sheet coming on databases and database management, and other fact sheets that are not completed are in the hopper. Now, these are somewhere between the range of 6 to 14 page fact sheets, so they're very detailed, and if you go online for them, you will find a lot of links, hot links, right in the fact sheet. Slide 41 is about the very popular listservs that are available for discussing volunteer monitoring issues and concerns. One is the one, Volmon List at EPA.gov, that Alice Mayo manages. The second one is the much newer CSRES Volmon List that Chris Stepanek at Wisconsin is involved with. And we encourage you to sign up for these lists if you're not signed up for them already. And there's been a lively exchange. Sometimes they're very quiet. But one of the things we've done is if there's an exchange that goes through more than a couple of queries on the usawaterquality.org site, we have archived the exchanges, so that you all can clean out your email boxes and get rid of those very informative emails that you're not quite sure what to do, and look at the responses and the exchanges at this website. There's a lot of state and local program. I'm on slide 42 right now, through county extension offices, high schools, natural resources departments, tribes, conservation districts, a lot of watershed organizations, and other volunteer monitoring groups. So there's a lot of support out there for programs. Moving right on to equipment. I'm on slide 43, changing track a little bit. Determining what you need can be daunting. You want to make sure you've got the equipment that'll meet your data standards, but you don't want to spend too much money on things. You don't want to spend too too little money on things. And really, the best thing to do is to check out and see what other programs are doing to figure out your equipment needs. And let's see, I'm going to move to slide 44 now, and there's a lot of way you can actually borrow and share some equipment through water districts, schools, again, through this whole listing of agencies. So you can have a chance to figure out if the equipment they have meets your needs or doesn't meet your needs, if you want to go to something a little bit more sophisticated, or again, if you want to go with something a little simpler. And on slide 44, these are a number of lists of the companies that you can purchase equipment through. I'm not going to go through that in detail. You can check that out for yourself. And a lot of them have some detailed information about each of the pieces of equipment that can help you make your decision. I'm going to skip slide 46, which is questions, and move on to slide 47, where we want to talk a little bit about program costs and funding considerations. The take-home message you need from this is that volunteer monitoring is cost-effective. It is not cost-free. And the one thing that I need to get across to people all the time, that just because it's called a volunteer monitoring program doesn't mean it's a free program. There are a number of things that need to be covered in time and effort and money from the incredibly hardworking staff, usually, if not always, underpaid, to beverages, transportation, insurance, which is a growing issue for volunteer monitoring programs, is having funding to provide insurance for events and things that are going on. This listing here are what you want to take into consideration when you're designing your program, that all these have costs attached to them. Moving on to slide 48, one of the things you might want to do is actually consider charging for services. My program, Watershed Watch, started charging for our participation in our program from the very start, and it has helped us tremendously. Because often people do value things that have a cost, and it can provide the program some support and stability. We charge on a per-site basis, on a per-year basis, for our monitoring sponsors. And so this is not a fee paid by the volunteers, but by the organizations that sponsor the monitoring. There is a what I call Linda's sliding scale of costs, and so that because I manage the finances, I can tailor that to what organizations can afford. But it helps organizations realize that there are costs too involved with monitoring. So many times you'll hear folks say, "Oh well, aren't they paying for it?" And I always ask them who that they is, and well, it's the state or the county. Well, more often than not, it's not. Moving on to slide 49, a lot of organizations and volunteer monitoring programs will use the volunteer monitoring effort as a match when they're applying for grants. It's also a great documentation to figure out what the values of volunteers are. Currently, the value of volunteering, whether it's water quality or any other aspect across the country, is a little bit over $18 an hour. So that is, although some organizations for match can only use minimum wage, it really makes you think a little bit more about the value of monitoring and how it can be used. But it's important if you're going to use your volunteer effort as a match, to make sure that you document the time that the volunteers spend doing the monitoring, whether it's on data sheets, whether it's on sampling events, and what the equivalent is. Moving on to slide 50. Another way to get a bigger bang for your buck, again, is to enter into partnerships where you're sharing resources. We found that in our area, there were several watershed groups that were working with the same goal and all going to the same meeting, all at the same time, and they now have pooled their resources. They're sharing some office space, they're sharing some staff, and they're alternating going to those interminable meetings. And we also find that there are useful partnerships for in-kind services. You may find a lab that can do an analysis that you'd like to get done that you can't afford to get done. You might have some linkages through your partnership to additional funding sources. So on slide 51, we can talk about getting the most for your money. You want to shop around. Vendor prices vary. What we have found for some of our groups is if we can purchase what they're interested in through the university, we get a university discount that they might not be able to get themselves. And there are quantity discounts. There are used and reconditioned equipment out there, and there's donated and borrowed equipment. Often laboratories from organizations, not university laboratories, but from private corporations or public corporations, may decide to upgrade their laboratories, and lots of good equipment becomes available. And that's something to tap into and find out. So I realize I'm on slide 52 that I have really just glossed over funding. Funding is crucial and certainly could be a subject of a webcast in itself. But we do know, and I just want to mention before I finish my part, that there are just some keys to funding success. And that's you need to tap into different funding sources. It can be devastating to a program to have one source of funding, have that source disappear, and then have to flounder for it. When the survey was done of volunteer monitoring programs back in 1998, they found out that the average program has about 7 different funding sources, and that all contributes to the security of financial basis for your program. And as we've all discovered who've been doing this for a while, it's often much easier to find startup funding than it is to find ongoing support. Monitoring, however, is by its nature long-term. And so funding needs to be long-term, and we need to keep talking about it and keep it focused and make people realize that having a grant that lasts for 3 years can be very useful, but that long-term monitoring really needs to extend much longer than that. On slide 53, I mentioned that another thing that's important is who's ever using the data should be helping to pay for it. If your county or state government is using your monitoring data, they should be helping to support your program. If a community is using the data, they should be helping to support it. They may be able to provide in-kind support. They may not be able to give you the cold cash, but it's all very, very crucial to keep programs going. And so to summarize my whole presentation, and before we move on to Danielle's, I'd just like to mention that when you're getting started with a program, start by addressing the tough questions. What do you want to do? How are you going to do it? And write it down. Involve partners who will help promote your program. Use a variety of training sessions. Seek a variety of sources of funding. Go on the web. There's lots of information out there. Go on to the listservs. Join the listservs. Read the Volunteer Monitor newsletters. You'll find out lots of information going right back to the very first issue. And remember, in all cases, applaud your volunteers, because without your volunteers, you will definitely not have a successful volunteer monitoring program. And so now I'm on slide 55, and I would like to thank you all for listening to me, and I would also particularly like to thank Elizabeth Heron from the University of Rhode Island, Chris Stepanek from the University of Wisconsin, our home agencies, and our volunteer monitoring program. They are the ones who actually did the lion's share of this presentation, and I appreciate their involvement. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Linda. And I do remind people to stay tuned for part 2 of our presentation. We are now on slide number 56, which is our next question and answer period. And, Linda, we've had a number of questions sent in. I do apologize in advance to folks. Based on the number of questions that are coming in, we will not be able to ask all of them, but we'll do the best we can. Linda, first question comes from Kelly in New York. We talked about how monitoring data can be used for educational purposes. Can you give some examples of how that might be done?
Oh, there's lots of classrooms where teachers are taking their students out to monitor a stream behind the school, using the World Water Monitoring Day kits to look at the pH, to look at the nutrient levels, to do a little bit measurement of clarity. Many of those programs are collecting the bugs in the stream, the macroinvertebrates. There are a number of programs with handouts available, so you can do some very simple identification in terms of figuring out if a stream is healthy or not. That's a small example of educational programs.
Thanks, Linda. We're hearing from Amber in Montana, who wants to know, in it, probably beyond just caring about their water body, caring about their streams, what other incentives are there to get students and adults involved in volunteer monitoring?
Well, certainly one of the incentives for students is many students have to put in hours for community service or as part of their National Honor Society, so that can be an incentive. We've had in our program a number of State Science Fair winners from students who started with the basics of our monitoring program and the way we do it and going to investigate further something that really appeals and interests them. We have parents who have gotten involved in monitoring with their kids as a way to get outside doing a family activity that doesn't involve athletic sports and carpooling to this soccer match or that football game. I've got one family who has been monitoring together for 6 years now. The boys have gone from being in grade school to being in high school. One's in college. We've had another program, another family where the dad provided the wheels, the daughter did the monitoring. She's now on her way to becoming a doctor.
We'll take one more question submitted online. This one comes from Teresa in Ohio, who notes that in her state, for her data to be considered credible to the state environmental agency, the program must have a qualified data collector on board. Do you know of any training available for persons to become qualified data collectors, and do other states require this?
I would have to say I am not sure of the answer to that question. That might be a good one to put to post to the volunteer monitoring listserv. And I'm not sure what a definition of a qualified data collector is. I'm sure the state has one. And it would be good for her to get in touch with a state regulator and find out exactly what the steps are to become a qualified state data collector and to see what kind of programs the state offer for people to reach that. And she might herself become one and see how to work that out. But again, what we're also finding is that a lot of data is used locally by local communities. And then when the states realize that it's good data or they don't have other data in that aspect, they may come to the groups themselves.
Thanks, Linda. At this point, I'd like to unmute the phone lines and see if there are any questions from those calling in. If you have a question, please identify yourself and be recognized.
This is Dave Toth from Philadelphia.
Yes, Dave in Philadelphia. Go ahead.
How do you ensure that the monitoring is, viable from your water monitors? Like sometimes they can go astray with their monitoring, or are they doing it correctly? Do you have periodic tests for them when you go out with them, or do you have like every 6 months you have a training program or something where you can ensure that they're doing the monitoring properly?
That's a great question, and that's actually a couple of the slides that I had to cut from my presentation.
Okay.
That is very, very important to do that. Many programs will have a staff person periodically go out and visit the volunteers and do some side-by-side monitoring with them to make sure they're doing it right. Others will have folks come back in periodically for retraining sessions. I've heard them called as quality assurance parties. So it's supposed to make it seem like it's more fun than onerous. But what I found is we have our volunteers in Rhode Island come in. Of course, Rhode Island is very small. They come in periodically. But what we find out is that people are very interested in making sure that they are doing the job right because it's their outside and extra time and effort. So we have never seen any reluctance from people to come and get retrained and get checked out. Some folks, if they can, they will send out reference samples for them to analyze. It all depends on the program. But that periodic rechecking is very, very important.
Thank you.
And thank you, Linda. Thank you for the questions. I'm now going to mute the phone lines. And we will resume with our presentation. But first, if you move to slide 57, this will be the first ever commercial in Watershed Academy. This is a quick word about our next webcast, which will be November 29th. Beth Hall of EPA's Office of Groundwater and Drinking Water, Sherry Stewart of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and Dr. Christopher Crockett from the Philadelphia Water Department will give a presentation entitled Protecting Drinking Water Sources. In this webcast, you'll learn about source water assessments required under the 1996 Safe Drinking Water Act and how this information can be integrated with other watershed protection programs to protect drinking water supplies. So please be sure to attend this informative webcast November 29th. Note that November 29th is the last Wednesday of the month rather than our regular third Wednesday broadcast date. Registration for this webcast will open on November 15th on the Watershed Academy website. That site is www.epa.gov, epa.gov/watershedwebcast. You can go to that site to register and for notices about upcoming webcasts. Now let's continue with today's webcast on volunteer water quality monitoring. Please advance to slide number 58, and we would like to hear from Danielle Donkersloot of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Danielle, are you out there?
I'm here, Ron. Thank you. Thanks, Linda, for sharing your expertise with us. Today I will be discussing New Jersey's approach to using volunteer collected data at the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. From this point on, I will refer to the Department of Environmental Protection as the DEP or department. Slide 60. I'm sorry, slide 59. Today, topics will be including the New Jersey Watershed Watch Network, changing the stereotypes of using volunteer collected data, our New Jersey Watershed Watch Network Advisory Council, our tiered approach to data credibility for volunteer collected data, different data users, data uses, and lessons learned. Slide 60. First, I'd like to share with you some information about my home state, New Jersey. The population of New Jersey is well over 8 million people. It's roughly 1,134 persons per square mile. There are over 7,800 river miles within the state of New Jersey, and DEP assesses 2,300 of those river miles, which leaves about 5,500 river miles not being assessed in the state of New Jersey. When we start talking about assessing waters in New Jersey, and we start looking at the numbers and we realize that there are over 5,000 river miles not being assessed, this proved to the agency that we needed to gather more information and more data. The department established a volunteer monitoring training program in 1992, but that program was designed to educate citizens about watershed ecology and non-point source pollution. But by 2002, we had trained over 3,000 people. And the idea came out that if we're training all of these people, why not start trying to fill in the department data gaps with some of those local monitoring efforts? Slide 61.
And Danielle, if I could interrupt here to remind folks that slide number 61 was inadvertently designed as a hidden slide. So if you are viewing this from your downloaded version, please right-click your mouse and follow the link that says go to slide and go to slide 61. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
It's all right. However, a handful of the water resource managers at the department believed that the volunteers could help meet our data needs. And at the same time, we started receiving much interest from the local watershed partners in the volunteer community saying that they too wanted to help start assessing New Jersey watersheds more holistically. So the agency and the local monitors, we all sat down together, and what we did was we created the Watershed Watch Network. Out of that, we created two councils. I have an internal advisory council, which is made up of our water monitoring and standards unit, our water assessment team, the Division of Watershed Management, and our Office of Quality Assurance. And in the same return, we also developed an external council made up of volunteer monitoring coordinators and watershed associations around the state. Some of these groups are river keepers, watershed associations, volunteer coordinators. I'd like to point out here for a second that we called it the Watershed Watch Network because we really needed to stress that we were networking with all of these partners. And a network is an interconnected system of things or people communicating in or within a group. So the idea of the Watershed Watch Network is really important to us here in New Jersey. Slide 62, please. One of the things that happened very, very shortly after creating these two advisory councils was when I was with my internal advisory council made up of agency folks, I realized that there were some myths about using volunteer collected data. There were issues that regarding the fact that volunteers may have hidden agendas, that volunteers are not scientists, and there's always the issue of quality assurance and quality control. However, at one of my internal meetings, I asked at the table of about 10 of my advisory members, how many of you are volunteers? And these were my agency folks that I was talking about. I said, how many of you volunteer for a water monitoring program? And about one-third of the room raised their hands. And I said, well, you're scientists and you're volunteers. You know, this kind of showed that there are well-trained state scientists and scientists helping and assisting these volunteer monitoring programs. Slide 63. The realities of using volunteer collected data was that we need more data at a higher frequency of collection. For example, in our biological monitoring program at the state of New Jersey, there's approximately 822 stations that are monitored once every 5 years. We need to be able to start using that volunteer collected information to start filling in those gaps. Well, what happens on the second, third, and fourth year? So we needed a higher frequency of collection. As Linda mentioned earlier, EPA has been encouraging the use of volunteer collected data since the 80s. And the reality, too, is volunteers want to do it right. Volunteers do not want to be wasting their time, and they do not want to be collecting information that will not be used by anyone. The advisory council also helped identify the different types of data uses, and then we organized these data uses in a way that made sense for the public and the agency. Some of the potential data uses, which I've heard through questions and during Linda's presentation, are educational purposes, non-point source assessment, regulatory response, identification of projects that should be happening now, like, for example, putting in a stream buffer in an area that does not have a buffer. Monitoring, the potential data use also is monitoring the success or failure of the restoration projects. Slide 65. Both advisory councils help to create what we call the four-tiered approach. This allows for volunteers to choose their level of monitoring involvement based on three basic facts. What is their intended purpose for monitoring? What do they want the data to be used for? And who do they want the data to be used by? Slide 66. This tiered approach is broken into four tiers, as I mentioned. Tier A is environmental education. Tier B is stewardship. Tier C is community assessment. And Tier D is indicators or regulatory response. So if you look at it, Tier A is for environmental education, and that's really where plugging into the World Water Monitoring Day would come into play. Where you have Tier D, which is regulatory response, that is really where volunteer monitoring community data can actually be compared to the data that the state collects. Let's go into a little bit more detail. Slide 67, I know you saw this slide earlier in Linda's talk, but I needed to stress it again because this slide really explains. If you think about the tiers, you know, with Tier A, you're in educational purposes and you're working on educational awareness. But as you move to Tier D, you start increasing the time you spend on the program, the level of rigor, level of quality assurance needed, and the expense also increases as well. Tier A, environmental education. this is how we broke the tiers up. Data users for Tier A would be participants, stewards, watershed residents. Data use would be promoting stewardship or raising that level of understanding for watershed ecology. The quality needed of this type of data, a low level of rigor, but use sound science. You know, if you're in a classroom and you're using a World Water Monitoring Day kit, you know, hitting on keywords like the vial says that you should stir it as opposed to shaking it. You know, this is just bringing home the points of there is science to the monitoring that we do. Slide 69. Tier B. Data users would be the participants within the monitoring program, watershed residents, landowners, and possibly local decision makers. The data use is to understand the existing conditions and any changes over time. This type of data can be used for screening, for identifying problems, and the quality needed for this type of data, low to medium rigor. A variety of study designs is acceptable, but you should have some kind of training, and you should have some kind of quality assurance project plan. Slide 70. Tier C is community and or watershed assessment. Here is where you're moving along that continuum and you're increasing the level of rigor, you're increasing the level of time, and you're increasing the level of expense for your monitoring program. For here, data users can be local decision makers, the watershed association, environmental organizations, possibly your state or local agencies. The data use is for assessing current conditions, tracking trends, source track down of non-point source pollution. The quality needed is medium or high level of rigor. The data needs to be reliable to detect changes over time and space. Quality assurance project plan approved and on file with the intended data user, and training is required. At this point, if you are striving for a higher level of data collection, and you would like your information to be used by the state, you should have the actual person at the state that you want the data to be used by reviewing your quality assurance project plan and approving it for their use, because nothing is more frustrating to a watershed management group than to go about their business monitoring for a 5-year study and then submitting it to the department only to find out that they weren't collecting at the proper frequency or they weren't using the proper meter. Slide 71. Tier D is indicators or regulatory response. Again, as I mentioned earlier, this is the tier where our data, the data that we collect at the department or the data that's collected at the state level, can be compared to the data that is collected by the volunteer monitoring group. The data users for this data is New Jersey DEP, local decision makers, watershed associations, environmental organizations. Data use is assessing current conditions and impairments, supplementing agency data collection, research, evaluating best management practices, and regulatory response. The quality needed, this is the highest level of rigor. This is where you'll need a study design and methods need to be evaluated and recognized by the agency using the data. Training is required. A quality assurance plan should be approved. In the state of New Jersey, we have an Office of Quality Assurance, the data user, and we also have an annual recertification fee. So when a group comes to me and says that they want to be a Tier D, we have to kind of work through the tiers like rungs on a ladder, in the sense that usually what happens is a group starts a program for educational purposes, but as they become more sophisticated and as they start seeing that they want the information being used by the agency, they start climbing these tiers, and then that's when they get to Tier D. 72. So who uses the data at the department. Watershed area managers use the data for Tier B, C, and D. The water assessment team is Tier D. The water assessment team is responsible for writing the integrated report, otherwise known as the 303D, 305B report to EPA. The non-point source program uses Tier C or D data. The 319 program, which is a grant program, 319 is a section of the Clean Water Act. They will look at Tier B, C, and D data. The TMDL program will look at Tiers B, C, and D, and other programs or divisions within the department as needed. These programs not only just said, I'll look at Tier C data, or I'll look at Tier B data and beyond. These programs are active members of our Watershed Watch Network Council. Some of the duties of these programs include providing advice to the volunteer program coordinators, reviewing study designs and quality assurance plans, and really communicating through myself, the volunteer coordinator, and the volunteer program so that we're all on the same page. So these groups don't just say, we'll use volunteer collected data. There's also a level of commitment on the department's end for supporting volunteer monitoring data. Slide 73. There are always issues with data quality. And here are some of the ways that the network has worked on addressing these data quality issues. Quality assurance criteria has been set for each tier and has been defined. Quality assurance plans or study designs are reviewed by coordinator and data user. Program-specific training and support is critical. For example, our agency provides a 2-day macro identification course for people that are conducting biological assessments every year. And then we also provide a methodology training, which is free to the public. We also provide study design training and data analysis training. Individual evaluations of each monitoring program are critical for helping address data quality issues. The volunteer coordinator needs to be the translator between the volunteer community and the regulatory community. I sometimes feel like I sit directly on the fence between these two, between the volunteer community and the regulatory agency. It really does take translation between these two because these two groups speak in different languages, really. And the biggest way to address data quality issues is through communication, and I cannot stress that enough. This four-tiered approach has been, well, I'm on slide 75, or 74, I'm sorry. This four-tiered approach has been successful in allowing the department to feel confident in using volunteer-collected information. This approach has also allowed the volunteer community to know up front what they have to do for the department to use their information. In 2005, the department included volunteer monitoring as part of our agency's 10-year monitoring plan. This means, in reading this report, which is called the State's Monitoring Matrix, by 2014, volunteer collected data is estimated to make up 1/3 of all water quality monitoring activities in the state. At this time, we will take a short question and answer break.
Thanks, Danielle. As Danielle mentioned, we are in our lone, unadvertised question and answer break. We are still on slide 74, but in the interest of time, we will go ahead and take some time for questions. Danielle, we have a question. Sorry, I lost it for a second there. Pete in Illinois notes that tiers B and C seem fairly closely related. Can you give examples of each of those?
Sure. Tier B and C always does seem to be very closely related. And sometimes we've actually even discussed collapsing those two tiers. But really what it is Tier B is the tier where people may have a study design and they might have their fixed monitoring locations, but they don't want to write a quality assurance project plan, or they don't want to identify macroinvertebrates beyond just using common name. So the level of quality assurance that's built into that Tier B is less than the Tier C. With the Tier C, we know that they have some form of quality assurance project plan that's either updated annually or when there are changes to the program. And they also are using a higher level of rigor built into their quality assurance for that tier. So really right now the tiers are going on a project-specific basis. I work with a volunteer organization to help them identify what tier they're in, and then I work with the data users within the department to find out if this is acceptable for the tier that they're trying to get into.
Great, thanks. You earlier showed a list of data users and how data was used for each tier.
Yes.
How did you identify the potential data users when planning a volunteer monitoring program? Or for that matter, how does anyone identify potential data users?
What we did with here at the agency is I went around to all the programs that we could find in the department and found people that are looking for water quality information. And we literally sat down in a room and we defined what type of information or data they're looking for and what level of quality they actually need. So defining who is going to be using these tiers was really a program-by-program call, and I needed to make sure that I reached out to all of the individual programs within the department so that they were aware of what the tiers were and aware of what we were doing with volunteer collected information.
Thanks, Danielle. At this time, I'd like to unmute the phones once again. And if there are any questions out there in phone land, please speak up.
This is Sandy from Toledo, and my question is,
I'm sorry, Sandy and Toledo, could you speak up, please?
Yes. How is your program funded? Is it funded with 319? Do you use it here where they use it for locally designated watershed programs? Do you use 319 there for this sort of activity?
The question relates to how the program is funded. Is 319 funding a major source of funds for the program?
319 funding is actually not a major source of funding for my program. My program is funded using what we call the corporate business tax within the state of New Jersey. And I have spent a great deal of time, as well as my manager, Kerry Flew, holding the tin cup, trying to catch all of the scraps of funding that might be left over throughout the department. So really, I've been very lucky in the sense that my department has been very supportive of using volunteer collected data. And that is what's been giving me the funding to do what I'm doing right now.
Other questions from the phone lines?
This is Jeanette in EPA Region 5.
EPA Region 5, go ahead.
Okay. I want to know if the training that occurs for these volunteers is done jointly with training of DEP staff. So, you know, it doesn't look like it's outreach to just those special volunteer groups, but actually includes the staff, which gives you that broader interaction with regular science folks and the needs of the agency.
Sure, Jeanette. I am always at almost every single training that we host, unless there is a flood or a natural disaster, which has occurred before. But I actually control who will be presenting at the trainings, and I control the topics. And every time I have council meetings in which I have the outside volunteer community come in every other month and sit down with me, and I ask them, what type of training do you need? Where are your shortfalls? Where can I help you? Are you okay with equipment? And we are starting a new training module called a day and a half training called a study design workshop. And that came directly out of the volunteer community saying to me, well, we need to better define what a study design is, and we need to, you know, sit down and really have a lesson and have a training on what study design is. So at that point, I looked around to some partners that I've seen them do their own study design workshops, and I asked them to help participate in a study design workshop. And then I also asked our internal folks what is really important to hit on for a study design workshop. So it is, there's always a state person there at the training. A lot of times our Office of Quality Assurance takes the training, and I've also had other partners take the trainings, as well as consultants, U.S. Geological Survey, and universities. So there's always a nice hand, there's always a nice group of experts on hand to help.
Thank you.
No problem.
Great. Thank you, Danielle, and thank you, everyone, for your questions. At this time, I'm going to mute the phones again and ask Danielle to continue with her presentation on slide 75.
Sure. We are currently on slide 75. Since the department has started to use this four-tiered approach, I've seen my share of concerns and successes, and I would like to share with you some of my lessons learned. A few of them that I'll go into more detail with is, you need to make this easier for the volunteer community. You can't just start throwing acronyms and lingo at them that agency people understand. It's really important to translate what you're trying to say to the volunteers. So making quality assurance easier for them is key. Another lesson learned was unattended data use and data users. Designing a new program should not be designed for a tier, and I'll go into these in detail. Clear quality assurance guidelines, and this is a big lesson, which is the agency or the department should not be the only group using the data. These volunteer organizations need to take ownership of the information that they're collecting. And this is a lesson that I learned from Linda, and every time she says it and every time I hear it, it brings a big smile to my face, which is volunteer monitoring is cost-effective and not cost-free. Let's go to slide 76. The next couple of slides are from a presentation that Jared Udell from the Hackensack Riverkeeper shared with us at the New Jersey Volunteer Monitoring Summit a few years ago. The first lesson that I wrote of was, make it easier for the volunteers. So this is coming right from Jared, where he says, you've gotten the approvals, you've chosen certain environmental parameters, you've selected monitoring sites, maybe even you have funding and some potential volunteers. So now what? Slide 77. Excuse the acronyms, but this was his next slide. He didn't know how to piece this all together. He was saying, what's a QAP, a quality assurance project plan, and what am I doing with EPA, and where do I get this equipment, and am I using volunteers from schools, and, you know, so this, he's trying to develop a program for educational purposes, Tier A, but this slide is showing that the pieces of his puzzle kind of overwhelmed him at first. Sorry for the acronyms. Slide 78. So I wanted to show here that this is also from Jared. This is his timeline. Notice how he started in November of 2002. He never realized how long it was going to take to develop a project like this. And at the time, we didn't have the tools and assistance that we have here at the agency. So my advice is to offer training and support in study design, quality assurance, monitoring techniques, data analysis, and data use. But look at Jared's slide here. You have in 2002, he had an idea. And the idea was that it would be nice to have volunteer monitoring within the high schools along the Hackensack River. And in 2003, he started monitoring, and then he was told he needed a quality assurance plan. So then the quality assurance plan process started. He received a grant, he recruited and trained schools. In 2004, he was still working on his quality assurance plan. He was still recruiting and training schools. So, and he was revising the plan on a regular basis. So you could see here that it takes a long time to get the program going from the idea to the implementation. Slide 79. Lessons learned number 2. Unintended data use and data users. One example is volunteer data was rejected by the 303D and 305B integrated report because of the sampling frequency. This group needed a tier D type data, and they needed a sampling frequency that was specifically spelt out in the surface water quality standards. So what happened was this volunteer monitoring group was funded by their local government for a one-year study project. The group developed a study design, they had a good quality assurance plan, but they didn't go through the volunteer monitoring coordinator, myself, nor did the intended data user review or approve the quality assurance project plan. And their sampling frequency was not adequate for regulatory response. However, the TMDL group at the agency found it very valuable because they were collecting data not just through the growing season, but for the whole year. So it gave this TMDL group an idea of what was going on with the stream in the winter as well. And we had never had data like that before on that particular stream. Lesson 3, I'm on slide 80. Do not design a program for a tier. Now that we have these tiers out, I'm hearing groups say, I've had groups contact me and say, you're driving us crazy with these tiers. We can't figure out what you want from us. We can't figure out how we're going to be collecting this information. And I tell groups that they should not be designing a program for the department. They should be designing a program to meet their own goals first. Otherwise, it could be very frustrating. So when these groups come to me and they say, we want the, our sole purpose is to have the department use our data, I push back at them and say that I need them to define their own monitoring purpose first. Why do they want to invest so much time in this type of program? Lesson 4, which is on slide 81. Clear quality assurance guidelines. Spell out who the data users are at your agency or in your group. Offer training and methodologies and procedures that are currently acceptable to the agency. Review all available resources and guidance, and then develop specific guidance for your state. Ask the groups what they need help with, and then help them. I always try, like I mentioned earlier, I do have meetings every other month with the volunteer community in New Jersey. And there's many times when I just say, okay, so what do you guys need? And I take what they need, and then I bring it back to the agency, and I say, you know, we need to do these types of trainings, or we need to purchase this type of equipment, or we need to better spell out quality assurance project planning. You know, we have to keep everything very clear. Slide 82, and I cannot stress this enough. This is data use. Organizations need to take ownership of their information. Organizations need guidance on different types of data uses available. They need to be able to share their success and failures. They need to be able to get the word out. You know, why are they doing this monitoring? They need articles and press releases. Find examples of how data has been used at all levels, local, state, national. Again, it's really critical that they take ownership of their own information. Slide 83. Now I would like to show you some examples of the different ways volunteer collected data has been used by our agency and the tier that these projects were assigned. In all examples, the volunteer group had their own purpose for the program first, and DEP was a secondary purpose. So this is going to be kind of a rhetorical question that I'll throw out there, and I'll give you some clues, but the idea is that now that we've talked about these tiers, I'm going to show you some examples of programs, and then I want you to try to guess what tier they're in. Slide 84. This slide was taken from Ross Kushner, one of the founders of the Pequannock River Coalition. This slide is explaining that why they chose temperature monitoring. Linda mentioned earlier that some of the most successful groups just start out with a few parameters. For the Pequannock River Coalition, they chose temperature. Why? Because there was documented fish kills caused by high river temperatures in 94 and then in 2002. Slide 85. Here you could see the association has electronic data loggers that are placed in the river at known monitoring locations, fixed monitoring locations. They have stations that are located where the data loggers can be checked frequently. The station locations are actually at the prime fishing spots within this watershed so that the anglers can go and just make sure that the data logger is still in place and is properly collecting the information. The loggers record temperature every 30 minutes. In early fall, the data loggers are removed and the data is downloaded. Slide 86. This is one of my favorite slides. Again, this is from Ross Kushner when he presented to the New Jersey volunteer community a few years ago. This slide says, are you certifiable? Probably. Here are some of the hoops that Ross's program jumps through. He has a dedicated laboratory manager with experience and training. He has a high-grade quality assurance project plan. There's quarterly calibration checks of the data logger. There's annual recalibration checks. There's solid documentation of the calibration checks, the deployment sites, and collected data. And they pay an annual licensing fee. So what tier is this group at? Well, since you can't respond back, let's go to slide 87. They're at tier D, regulatory response. This program has gone through the full process, and their quality assurance plan was not only assigned by the data users here at the department, but was also assigned by our Office of Quality Assurance. Slide 88. You'll see, so was this worth Ross Kushner's time and the Pequannock River Watershed Association? And his answer is yes. What they did was, they were able to use their information to identify high-grade or exceptional-value tributaries and tracts of land within the area. They had an impairment listing on the Pequannock River Coalition, and an impairment listing refers to the integrated report. They received an expedited TMDL. There were modifications to the existing water allocation diversion permit, with temperature and flow requirements finally put in. They have a higher level of stormwater management, and they have better protection of streams and rivers and buffers. Because of his monitoring program, there are actually 300-foot buffers placed on either side of the Pequannock River and its surrounding tributaries. Next, slide 89, we're going to play another name that tier. Slide 90, please. In November 26, 2004, the Athos-1, a single-hull tanker, leaked an estimated 265,000 gallons of oil into the Delaware River. Delaware River oil spill volunteers, what happened was there were volunteers that started contacting us immediately to find out what they can do for their local streams and rivers. There was a basic study design in place. There were assigned segments, assessment tip sheets. Data sheets were standardized with the state protocol, but there were no fixed monitoring locations. There was no quality assurance project plan, and there was no formal training. Slide 91. Within hours of the accident, the Delaware Riverkeeper's volunteer monitoring coordinator, Faith Zerbe, and I started receiving calls and emails from concerned citizens and volunteers asking what they can do to help. FACE develops a tip sheet for conducting visual assessments, a data sheet, an emergency contact list, and a photo guide of what to look for as the volunteers were out there. I was working within my agency to standardize our data sheet with theirs and to receive assignments for the volunteers for what our Natural Resource Damage Claims program called areas of concern. Slide 92. This is an example of the tip sheet that FACE put together. It's showing some of the different terms that we were using: oil in creek along stream bed, oil stains at low tide, unbroken rainbow appearance. These were all terms that we were using when we were speaking with the volunteers. Slide 93, the volunteers were reporting on boom placement and malfunction. Slide 94. So what did the volunteers document? 15 New Jersey tributaries suffered oiling. 1 Delaware tributary suffered oiling. 4 New Jersey beaches suffered oiling. 3 wildlife preserves suffered oiling. And various main stem Delaware River locations. So when the volunteers were out there doing this documentation, there was an open line of communication from the command center, which is the group in charge of the cleanup, and the volunteers through FACE and I. Slide 95. So how did the Delaware Riverkeeper use the data? They used the data for looking for emergency response and cleanup vigilance, talking with the Coast Guard, and officials checking on the scope of oiling. They used the data for the press, and they used the data to increase the citizen base for advocacy issues. Slide 96. So how did our department use the data? The Natural Resource Damage Assessment Program was able to review the volunteer-collected data and see where there was what they were calling recoverable oil. So if there was areas where they could remove the oil, they would. And the program also looked at where the agency should be concentrating their cleanup efforts and where there were breakdowns in communication. The volunteers had the ability to contact FACE or I 24 hours a day. And if they spotted something that needed immediate attention, we had direct communications with the officials. So what tier do you think this is? Slide 97, this was Tier B. And again, even though this was a Tier B project, this information proved to be invaluable to the department. I have one more name of that tier for everybody. Now we're on slide 99, Vanson Brook. In 2000, the Bergen County Environmental Council was trained by myself, in the Save Our Streams protocol. By 2001, the Environmental Council notified me that there was a potential restoration project. And you'll see in this photo of this slide, this was their actual monitoring location. So you could see the one bank had absolutely no vegetation on it at all. In 2002, the DEP awarded $100,000 from the 319H program, which again is a grant program from the Clean Water Act. Slide 99. The outcome was 250 feet of restoration at the volunteer monitoring site. There was a pond on site that was dredged from an in-kind match. There was also a large zoo on site, and the zoo was actually sewered so that it would stop all of the animal waste would stop running off into the pond and into the stream. And then they also received another $100,000 from another local source for a buffer restoration at their second site. And they're still out there monitoring, and it's been about 6 or 7 years now. So they are, if you go to slide 100, that project is at a Tier B as well. slide 101. We'll now be opening up for questions. Thank you.
And thank you, Danielle. We do have a few minutes to answer additional questions. First, a couple notes. As mentioned earlier, due to the high volume of questions that have come in, we will not be able to answer all questions. We do apologize for that. But this could be viewed as an opportunity. If you do not already belong to either of the volunteer listservs that Linda announced earlier, this would be a great chance for you to join those listservs, and you can post your questions there. Take it from somebody who is a member of the listserv. There are a lot of interesting discussions that go back and forth on a number of topics, so please do take advantage of that opportunity. I would also like to, again, draw everyone's attention to where you can obtain the speaker's contact information if you're participating with us online. Simply click onto the home button at the top of your screen. From there, you'll be returned to the home page, which has the speaker's email addresses and phone numbers. At the bottom of that same home page, you'll find two additional items. One is the link to additional resources, which I mentioned at the beginning of today's session. Clicking this link will direct you to several useful watershed and wetland resources from EPA as well as other organizations. Also, if you advance your slide to slide 102, you will see the direct link to the additional resources page. The second item at the bottom of the homepage, as well as on slide 102, is our seminar feedback form. Please consider completing this form as we do consider your comments while working to improve our webcast. Now we do have a time for additional questions. I will start with the one submitted online. Danielle, we're hearing from Ernest in Indiana, who has a several-part question for you. How many staff do you have allocated for A, data quality assessment verification, and how many staff do you have for training volunteers?
Those are great questions. The first answer to your question is how many staff do you have allocated, I believe that was the question, for quality assurance. And for the whole program of volunteer monitoring at the state of New Jersey, there is myself, and then I have a part-time staff person that gives us about 20 hours a week. So that requires me to put in a lot of time and a lot of effort on my own. As far as quality assurance goes, I'm always able to ask questions of the professionals around me. So there are lots of times when I might go to the Office of Quality Assurance and ask them. There are other times where I ask the professional monitoring staff at the DEP for assistance. So I do have access to people within the department to ask these types of questions too. As far as the training goes, a lot of times if the training is not in my area of expertise, I will actually hire trainers to assist me. But again, I am still always at those trainings.
Thanks, Danielle. Michael from New York writes in, kind of an interesting situation, asking, what are important considerations for organizing groups in rural areas? In Michael's watershed, about half are part-time residents who live in the city, in his case, New York, and half are native rural folks. Many people are also of elderly age, as rural areas have an aging population. Do you have any suggestions? And Linda, please also feel free to chime in here. Do you have any suggestions on considerations that should be made in these cases?
As far as the rural communities, if you do have part-time residents that are spending their time, say, in the mountain regions outside of New York City, you can always make that watershed connection to them. New York City's water is coming from the Catskills region and beyond. So you can kind of, it helps to really touch on the watershed ecology principles and to touch on the fact that, you know, this is a connected water system from the people within the city and the people in the rural communities. I do not have a lot of experience working in rural communities. We do have some pockets of rural community within New Jersey, but for the most part, you know, I have asked my counterparts in Pennsylvania for assistance on answering some of those questions, like how do you conduct, for example, regional training when you only have three people that are interested within a region. But if Linda has any other additional information on that question, I'll be happy to share the platform.
Well, some of the things that we do in Rhode Island, we don't have so much the part rural, part urban. We have people who are up for the summer and gone for the winter. But what we do for all our volunteers is we provide them with a monitoring schedule, and they have the flexibility to pick whichever day of the week they want to do their monitoring. So the day of the week, it's up to them. Some people do prefer weekends, some prefer weekdays, and that has helped us tremendously. And then when our volunteers actually bring water samples into us, we give them a several-day period to bring their water samples in so that we don't have everybody coming in at once. And that includes weekdays and weekends. So anybody who does volunteer monitoring coordination knows it involves a lot of weekends and nights. So the ability to be flexible is very, very important.
Great. Thank you both. At this point, I'd like to unmute the phone lines one last time. Are there any questions from the phone land?
For a modem or anything like that? No.
I'm sorry, sir? Any questions out there? Okay. At this time, then, I'd like to conclude today's webcast. I'd like to especially thank Linda Green and Danielle Dachsluth for presenting today. And, of course, thanks to everyone who joined us. A reminder again about our next webcast, Protecting Drinking Water Sources, Assessments and Opportunities, to be held, November 29th. That's November 29th. Registration for that webcast will open on November 15th on the Watershed Academy website, which is www.epa.gov/watershedwebcasts. That's webcasts with an S. Finally, be sure to check out EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds homepage. That page is www.epa.gov/OWOW. Oh, wow. There you'll find links to information on funding, training, tools, and other technical assistance. We just added several new features, including a Watershed Tool of the Month. This month's tool is the Cooperative State Research, Education, and Extension Services Volunteer Water Quality Monitoring National Facilitation Project. We're also showcasing a targeted watershed project success story out of Tennessee and Kentucky. That ends our webcast for today. Thank you very much.